Team GB have won two more gold medals at the Rio Olympics. Rowers Heather Stanning and Helen Glover have retained the women's pair title they won in London 4 years ago. The men's four were also victorious to take Team GB's tally to six golds so far. A man who drugged and raped two men after inviting them to his photography studio in Bristol has been jailed, Charlie Maggs reports.
43-year-old Nigel Wilkinson offered his victims a free photo shoot after finding them on social media. Here's Detective Constable Stacey Matthews.
He would then drug them with different types of drugs and then go on to rape them.
Detective Sergeant Jenny Farman praised victims for their bravery.
He was a cunning sexual offender who used his photography enterprise as a cover and catalyst for his deviant activities.
It's thought he may have targeted others.
And if anybody believes they are a victim of his, then we will support and believe them.
Wilkinson was sentenced to 11 and a half years in jail.
Labour's ruling bodies won a legal judgment meaning it can reinstate a block on newer members voting in the upcoming leadership election. Earlier this week, the High Court decided it was against party rules to impose a restriction on anyone who joined in the last 6 months unless they paid £25. Now the Court of Appeals decided Labour can do that. Leadership challenger Owen Smith says court battles aren't helping the party.
I don't think, by and large, we should be in the courts debating these things. It should be something that is established within the Labour Party. So I don't think it's anything unusual for us to be going down this route.
Two six-year-old girls have been sexually assaulted at the Legoland theme park in Windsor. Police say it happened yesterday lunchtime. Two people have been detained for questioning after a series of bomb blasts targeting tourist resorts in Thailand. At least four people have been killed and more than 30 are injured. And the UK construction industry has fallen back into recession. Output dropped again in the second quarter of this year. That follows a dip in the first 3 months of 2016. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, I was hoping for a bit of news from the balloon fiesta. Not a lot of balloons taking off today, though. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news will be the leader of the Lib Dem group and councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, 20 years ago this week, on Tuesday the 13th of August 1996, three arrests for kidnapping young girls were made in Brussels that would lead to the biggest scandal and cover-ups and public demonstration ever seen in Belgium. It was the beginning of the so-called De True state-sponsored child sex abuse affair, which has horrifying echoes in the US Franklin scandal and our very own UK VI paedophile inquiry, where the government department, the Home Office, under suspicion, has provided the civil servants, would you believe, to assist with the inquiry, and also where, after three resignations, the fourth chair was appointed yesterday. After the 6 o'clock news, we ask what we found out about state-sponsored child sex abuse in Brussels, the capital of the European Union and the headquarters of NATO, and similarities with the US MK Ultra human experimentation programme by the CIA. Plus, has Turkey gone over to the side of the Russians this week? And if so, the US have 50 nuclear weapons based there. So which side are those weapons on? Plus, we catch up with some items from last week with Susan Lindauer, the CIA's negotiator in Libya and Iraq, and, would you believe, Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius, mostly dry and windy. This weekend, highs of 21, mainly cloudy but dry weekend with some sunny spells. Doesn't say a lot about the wind. I do hope some of those balloons get a chance to lift off. Next week, highs of 27 Celsius, mainly sunny week with temperatures peaking on Tuesday. Possible thundery showers on Wednesday. Wow, 27 degrees. Going to be hot, folks. Next weekend, the 20th and 21st of August, highs back down to a bit more normal, which is 21 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That's next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, although he's on his way here from Avonmouth at the moment, is the leader of the Lib Dem group and councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. We'll be talking to him in about 20 minutes or so. But to start with, Martin, one of the main bits of news today, we just heard on the bulletin there from the Murdoch Sky News, is that the Labour Party has won its appeal to overturn the High Court decision, which will mean that something like 130,000 new members that have joined the Labour Party since January won't get a chance to vote in this, I suppose it's 6 weeks or so now, a month or so away, the leadership contest.
Yes, well, the NEC, the existing NEC,
is the National Executive Council.
National Executive Committee, has spent over £250,000 of the party's money appealing against party members being allowed to participate in this election.
So how much, I'm just going to do some maths here. How much did each of these people pay to join the party, these 130,000?
Well, it depends whether they've paid the 25 quid or they've paid the lower rate. But I mean,
even if they paid the lower rate, I mean, I'm saying a few pounds from each of those people has been used to basically tell them, no, you're not going to be allowed to vote.
Yeah, and don't forget, it was the NEC that took this decision. But of course, there's just been an NEC election in which the candidates supporting Jeremy Corbyn won a clean sweep. So there's six seats up for grabs. I voted in it a couple of weeks ago, and all of those seats, so those people don't take their seats until after the Labour conference in September, and it's quite sure that if they had been in place, none of these appeals would have gone through. They wouldn't even have tried to try and ban these people from voting. So it's a bit of a mess, really.
It's interesting to hear Owen Smith on the news there saying he thinks that money should not be spent in this way.
Well, I think that's right, because, I mean, obviously, if eventually these people do get to vote, and they will get to vote, maybe they won't.
Martin, are you missing the point here? Because on the National Executive Committee, it's his supporters that voted for this appeal.
Well, no. I think what Owen Smith is trying to do is put himself in a position where he's not supporting the right wing of the party, trying to prevent people from voting. He wants to present himself as some kind of centrist candidate figure. And of course, at one stage, they were even claiming that a lot of these new people were actually people who were going to vote for him. Well, I don't think that's true, but that was what they were claiming. And I think, you know, he must realise that it looks pretty bad when you've got 130,000 keen people who want to participate, and you spend your time telling them, no, we don't want you.
Look, listening to that news bulletin, it just struck me from the Sky News does come from the Murdoch Empire. It's beamed out right across the country as the news. But what they're doing is they're using the person who would benefit from this court case today to say, I think it's a bad idea. And yet that's £250,000 of Labour members' money being spent on something which actually benefits, or is likely to benefit Owen Smith. Well, I mean, what I'm saying is, this is kind of spin involved.
There is.
Just the way that this was presented on the news just now.
Well, there is. There's an awful lot of spin involved. I mean, a lot of the people around Owen Smith are spin doctory type people, and they're trying to spin it in such a way that their chap has some chance of winning when it comes to a vote later in the summer.
Dad was a senior manager in BBC Cardiff and got him a job there, and he also got him a job under Alan Little at the Today programme, BBC Radio 4's main flagship current affairs programme.
Well, that may be so. I mean, and also, of course, his links with Pfizer, the drug company, have been exposed. I think it's quite interesting because the original contenders to remove Jeremy Corbyn have all fallen by the wayside. I mean, Angela Eagle, for example, voted to go to war in Iraq. And I thought we settled that when we got rid of David Miliband.
Again,
we don't want anybody on that side, on that wing of the party, leading the party.
It comes back to the propaganda, the spin side of things, because the reason, it's pretty clear to me, Angela Eagle stepped aside for Owen Smith to take over is because she made such a mess on the Daily Politics show with Andrew Neil. She just couldn't answer the the questions, and she was looking like she didn't know what she was doing.
Given the electorate that she's trying to appeal to, which is probably the most conscious and socialist-minded people in the country, 500,000 of them, she just wasn't going to win. No chance whatsoever. I don't think Owen Smith's going to win either, but he'll probably do rather better than she was going to.
Aren't we moving into a bit of a strange age, really? I mean, this is nothing new about this in the last generation or a couple of generations, where our political leaders are really chosen for their kind of TV personality cred.
They are, but I think what's beginning to happen with both Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn in Britain is that that era of spin and mismanagement is gradually dissipating, and people are genuinely looking for people who are genuine candidates with genuine views, warts and all. And that's what they want, that's what they're after. And it's a bit exasperating for the spin doctory type people, because they're used to basically coming up with advertising slogans, etc. And of course, we may be moving out of that era altogether.
Well, bringing it a bit closer to home, we've had Jeremy Corbyn in Bristol on Monday evening this week, and also Bristol West constituency Labour Party has defied Thangam Debonair, who's their MP, to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. Labour members, this is on Bristol 24/7, Louis Emmanuel writing this, Labour members in MP Thangam Debonair's constituency have voted to back Jeremy Corbyn in the leadership election race. Bristol West constituency Labour Party voted 267-64 in favour of Corbyn to submit their nomination. The move, which has no formal impact on the election, follows similar votes in Bristol East and Bristol North West to overwhelmingly back the leader who visited the city on Monday. It also follows allegations of abuse and bullying at Debonair's last constituency Labour Party meeting. Well, Martin, you're a member of that Labour Party.
I was actually in that meeting, and it was a very orderly meeting. Both sides had a fair chance to put their case. There was the way it was managed, which had one pro-Corbyn, then one pro-Smith speaker.
But it's not very nice if Thangam Debonair isn't there because she feels she's going to be intimidated and bullied by people like you.
Well, that's up to her. She's entitled to be there. If she doesn't want to come, she doesn't have to come. The fact of the matter is, there's no point people getting upset about disagreements in politics. I mean, this is all very unfortunate in one way, having this kind of debate going on in the Labour Party about who the leader should be, but I'm willing to accept that the right wing of the party are genuinely genuine in their views that they don't want Corbyn, and we're genuine in our views that we do. There's no reason for everybody to get upset. Let's just deal with
it. One of the disputes is over where refugees come to Britain, that men should be given some kind of re-education to make them a little bit less misogynistic. Isn't that right?
Well, that's what Thangam said the other week, but it was picked up by Hibak Jama, who's the local councillor for Lawrence Hill, where we are, saying, well, why do you presume that refugee men in particular need this kind of advice? She herself, of course, was the daughter of a refugee man who brought her up on her own. And, you know, it was just a rather unfortunate turn of phrase by Thangam, I think.
Well,
but Hibak picks up on it.
Maybe she's thinking that some men from other parts of the world, maybe different faiths, religions, whatever, may come to Britain and bring with them this baggage of misogyny.
Well, maybe they will, but don't forget there's plenty of people who live in Britain and have lived here forever who've got similar baggage of misogyny. Why presume that refugees are the people who are misogynistic?
You're talking about your sort of Afghan.
Well, exactly. I mean, the misogyny is an issue, but not just for refugees, let's face it.
So, what would this result for both Kerry McCarthy and Thangam Debonair facing possible deselection and a new candidates for before the next election? But that's not going to be till 2020.
No, I don't think it is, because don't forget that I can't remember what it's called, but the Parliament Act that was passed by the coalition means that there can't be an election till 2020 unless some very, very extreme conditions are met. So even if Theresa May decided that she wanted to go to the country, she'd find that it's not straightforward. She'd either have to repeal the Act, or she'd have to try and engineer a vote of no confidence, which she lost, both of which
she's
are quite tricky things
that.
To do.
Listen, she's not going to do that. She's managed to manoeuvre her way into the top job, although some people would allege that even Prime Minister isn't really the top job. The City of London kind of runs things. But she's managed to manoeuvre herself into that with no vote of the Conservative Party members, which 150,000 of them didn't get any kind of say day and whether Theresa May was going to take over from David Cameron. I almost forgot his name then for a minute. It's just amazing how politics moves so fast. But Theresa May, there's absolutely no chance of her going to the country because she may lose.
Well, in any case, it's not straightforward for her to do that. In the past, she might have decided to call a snap election. But in actual fact, you can't just call a snap election anymore because there's actually various legal obstacles been placed in the way of it. So there's very little chance that that's going to happen. I think we may end up having an election before 2020, because don't forget there's an awful lot of stuff to come down the road between now and then, you know, including, geopolitical conflicts, banking collapse, goodness knows what, and all of these things eventually may feed through into a vote of no confidence being lost in the House of Commons. But at this stage of the game, it's not on the cards.
Okay, so really this vote by Bristol West is pointless, isn't it? Because it's not going to make any real difference until 2020, if it does, even then.
Well, it's not going to make any difference to the election results in the Labour Party either, because it's a secret ballot where people will ballot according to, with ballot papers.
All I'm saying is your party is going off in two different directions. You've got a whole bunch of MPs who were elected last May who think one thing, and a whole bunch of members and activists and trade unions who are heading off in a different direction. And actually, that different direction they're heading off with, including Jeremy Corbyn, doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with the Parliamentary Labour Party.
No, but what may happen and what will happen is that the Conservatives, for their own reasons, are going to try and gerrymander the constituencies. They're going to reduce the number of MPs, which means they'll have to change all of the constituency boundaries. Now, given the existing Labour Party rule book, that means that everybody whose boundaries changed comes up for reselection or deselection.
If that helps Jeremy Corbyn, they may just simply not do that.
Well, they've promised that they are going to do it, and don't forget that's part of the problem is that the Labour Party is playing along with all of this, saying, oh, well, we've got to get somebody middle of the road because they're going to rig the election against us, and it's under first past the post, you've got to be middle of the road to win under those conditions. And I would argue that we should start questioning, as a Labour Party, okay, the constitutional settlement under which elections are held.
Okay, I'm going to put a little scenario to you. That is that in a few weeks' time, Jeremy Corbyn is re-elected by the membership of the party, minus the 130,000 as the new leader of the party, and the MPs simply say, well, we're just going to ignore that and we're going to elect Owen Smith as the leader, and so they have their own front bench in Parliament.
Yep.
Actually, the Speaker is the person who's going to make this decision. He's going to recognise the MPs. He's not going to recognise people
well,
like you.
If that's the road they choose to go down, some of them are talking like that, some of them are not, because don't forget, if they want to win this, they've got to demonstrate to the party membership that they are team players. Now, they will all realise that although there's not going to be an immediate reselection, there will be in the long run a reselection, not in the medium
term.
It's easy
for you to say this, but the MPs are insiders at Westminster. They've seen a lot of stuff that you and I don't see, and they have decided Corbyn is just simply not going to work, and that Owen Smith is. And if they see that, surely they're entitled to say, we don't think Jeremy Corbyn is up to the job.
Well, if that's what they choose to do, then the steps that will be taken following that is that trade unions, most of the trade unions, will decide to defund those MPs, their constituency offices and so on.
Well, they already have done that.
Yeah, that's already happening. And, of course, we can, given the majority that we've got inside the Labour Party now, change the Labour Party rules so that they can be deselected. And if they're going to rebel against the elected leader, then I would suggest that's probably the only thing that
can happen. But the Labour Party's likely to end up like the Greens or some kind of fringe party in that case. And you'll have a new party, which Kerry and others will be part of, maybe, I don't know, called the Democratic Labour Party or something. You have no idea. And they are going to be the ones in power.
Well, they'll be the ones in Parliament, but they won't be in power because the Tories are in power. Ultimately, of course, this will bring up the question of whether we should have a first-past-the-post electoral system, which leads to these kind of anomalies.
No, that is certainly not going to change before the next general election.
Oh, isn't
it? I know it's a bugbear of yours, but I'm just looking at what practically is going to happen in 2020.
Well, before 2020, if the election doesn't happen until 2020...
Yeah, assuming it's not going to.
All right, okay? Let's presume it's not going to, and let's presume that the right wing of the Labour Party set up their own breakaway party in Parliament. that break, those people will be deselected by the Labour Party. They will lose their Labour Party whip. They will lose the support of the trade unions, the financial support of the trade unions, and so on.
Well, they'll choose their own whips, won't
they? Well, that's
fine.
They
don't need the Labour
Party. That's fine, but in that case, we will have two. We'll have a Labour Party, and we will have this new party, whatever they want to call it, Social Democrats, whatever they want to call it. And then we will see what the opinion polls show. I think the opinion polls will show that the Labour Party, will retain the majority support
So I suppose what will be crucial then is, for example, next May's local elections.
Indeed.
And those kinds of elections, to see just how, you know, after a split, how the two different parties
indeed,
do.
And of course it'll all be done under first past the post, which will make a complete lottery of it. So if the UKIP vote stands up, that will possibly let the Labour Party in Tory seats, and if the right-wing Labour Party vote stands up, that will probably let in the Tory in Labour seats. But it will be a lottery, as it is not anymore in Northern Ireland, Scotland or Wales.
Yeah, but of course, in England it still is. It's not going to be a lottery. People will either vote for what they consider to be the real Labour Party, that is the Parliamentary Labour Party, the MPs, or they will vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And he had certainly a very good chance this week to put his case to Bristol, with something like 2,000 people roughly turning out on College Green to hear him. But before he started, there was a kind of various kind of warm-up acts. Maybe that's a bit unkind to call them that. Supporting acts. One of whom was from the very popular trade union right around the country. That is Steve Preddy from Unite. So let's have a listen to what he had to say before Jeremy Corbyn arrived.
In Britain today, we have business leaders and bankers committing willful acts against the general public and their employees, which in any other sphere of life would see equivalent crimes dealt with through the courts and many facing imprisonment, as we're seeing in Iceland and as we're now seeing in Ireland. Yeah. We have the speculative behaviour of reckless bankers causing the financial meltdown of the finance and banking sectors, and subsequent worldwide recession, which we've still not recovered from. The recent revelations around Philip Green and the ransacking of employers' pension funds is not the first time. And of course, I'm proud to say that Unite was front and centre in publicly exposing the shameful acts in Sports Direct, where employees forced to work zero-hour contracts, people timed while they went to the toilet, paid below the legal minimum wage, and the disgrace of a woman giving birth to a child in a warehouse toilet. That is Britain today. These are just a small number of the examples that reflect the gross imbalance of our society and across the industrial landscape of our country. And of course, our detractors will say, how are we going to pay for all this? And I would say, how are we, as one of the wealthiest countries in the world, still claiming not to be able to afford to do things and then claim that Britain is a fair society? We can't.
Well, obviously, I mean, what he's doing there is picking up on the genuine grievances that people have out there in the real world, which this Labour Party election is all about, if you like. And, you know, there's a mood out there of extreme... people are extremely fed up with the bankers being let off and the ordinary folk being handed the bill for it all. And somebody has got to articulate that and articulate it strongly. And obviously many people believe that to be Jeremy Corbyn because of his track record.
Now, I just want to point about these unions. I think particularly union leaders like Steve, when they're speaking, this is why we pay our TV licence fee to the BBC. I was banging on about them last week, not transmitting the debate, and there's going to be another one tonight between Corbyn and Smith. These should be transmitted live so we can actually hear our politicians. Back in the old days, you used to have to go to the hustings in the city centre and you'd hear your politicians. Nowadays, we've got the ability to just let the speech be heard so people can make their mind up about who they want to vote for. But no, the BBC don't like transmitting Jeremy Corbyn's speech, even though he's the elected leader of the opposition, and they don't like transmitting union leaders' speeches at all. They never do it, and so that's why I take great delight in doing things like transmitting Steve's speech there. Just looking at the membership of Unite the Union, Martin, 1.42 million members. This is an order of magnitude higher than any of the political parties. If you look at a trade union, you can imagine probably 10 times more people will be a member of that than they are of an actual political party, which we hear these political leaders all the time on the TV and radio.
Yeah, but you've got to remember that many of those are passive members.
Well, many of the members of the Labour Party or Conservative Party
That's less and less true. I mean, the Labour Party membership is becoming an activist membership.
My
again.
Point really is that actually the trade unions are a lot more democratic than these political parties. One of the things that Jeremy Corbyn's promising to do is actually to re-inject a bit of democratic politics into the Labour Party so that the annual conference plays a much bigger role, for example, in setting policy.
Well, indeed, and that is in line with what the trade union mainstream wants to see.
It shouldn't be about electing a bunch of people that just run away and then go and do what they want.
No, of course not. And of course, in the past, it was well understood that we used to talk about the parliamentary wing and the industrial wing of the movement and the cooperative wing. So traditionally, the Labour movement was made up of three slabs or bits, if you like. One of which was the trade union members. The other bit was the cooperatives and cooperative shops and the cooperative movement. And the third wing was the parliamentary party, which represented the other two in Parliament. We've moved on from that. Bizarrely enough, the right wing of the party wanted to bring in one person, one vote, because they thought it would undermine the more radical trade unions. And in actual fact, it's turned out that the people who want to join the Labour Party, in fact, as they've always been, are the people who want to change society. Those people have to recognise, and I'm one of them, that we've got a long way to go to convince the majority of people of our views. But on the other hand, people don't join the Labour Party to support the status quo.
This is what politicians always say, we're going to change things. Anyway, one other bit of news about the unions today is that the GMB Union, General Municipal Boilermakers Union, 43,419 of their union members voted out of 600,000 members, which is not very many.
No.
But of those, 60% voted to endorse Owen Smith.
Well, that's absolutely okay if that's what those people want to do. But as you've just pointed out, the vast majority of the members of the union didn't participate in the ballot one way or the other.
But the other interesting thing about this is that there are moves, aren't there, even in general elections and larger elections, to say, well, if somebody doesn't get enough of a vote, and not enough people vote, I mean, they're talking about this particularly with strike action and trade unions, then actually that vote is not valid. So there's an attempt for the government to start spelling out to trade unions, basically what their constitution should be. And so if for example, if not even half of the members vote in a particular vote, then that vote is going to carry no weight whatsoever legally.
Well, in actual fact, don't forget that these votes are just recommendations anyway. It's part of the politicking around the leadership election. And the individual members of the GMB who are members of the Labour Party will be able to vote in the election any way they like. The GMB's recommendation will be taken, people can either accept it or reject it. And the other unions that have supported Corbyn, that I don't suppose they've got huge numbers of people voting in favour of that either. So in actual fact, it'll come down to those who are members of the party who will be allowed to vote, and we'll see what the results are. I suspect that the 130,000 who are now going to be denied votes are going to be pretty cross about that, but I suspect that they are mostly pro-Corbyn, and there's a long way to go going forward. I don't want those people to go away. If you're denied your vote this time, folks, what I'd say to you lot is hang around, because there's plenty more to be done.
Looking at UKIP, they're an absolute farce at the moment, because the three main candidates for their leadership to take over from Nigel Farage, none of them are allowed to actually stand as leaders in the UKIP elections, which just seems totally ridiculous. But just another example of how our politics seems to be kind of sabotaged at the moment, post the Brexit vote. But UKIP, Martin, Lisa Duffy has been calling for a partial ban on the full face veil. She's one of the leadership hopefuls that no one really has ever heard of before. But anyway, she doesn't want a general law banning the veil, but she said there's some places it shouldn't be allowed. Now, this comes at the same time as in France, there's actually quite a lot of the French fashion houses in Paris have been designing these burkinis as part of the range. This is a full-length swimsuit for women to wear, Muslim women to wear, and they're getting rather popular. Now, there was a burkini-only event in France, and there were death threats sent to the people who were organising it, so they had to cancel it, or they said they had to cancel it. Lo and behold, down at Cannes, I think it was, one of the mayors then said, he's going to ban any use of the burkini in France at all.
Well, a burkini, of course, is not a full-face veil. It's just a sort of swimsuit that an Edwardian lady would recognise, which protects their modesty even though they're swimming. To my mind, there is some case, for example, for saying that if you're going to be a nursery teacher, you can't have a full face veil. You do need to be able to look into the eyes, and the children need to be able to see your faces and so on. And I must admit, I'm not particularly keen on seeing people in full face veil. But in a free society, adults are allowed to wear any clothes they like. Surely that is a principle. If people want to have blue hair, or they want to have tattoos, they're entitled. And if they want to wear a burqa, they're entitled to do that too.
And in swimming, it does seem rather strange, though, that the French government should react actually almost as if in the same way in this case as the people who are issuing the death threats.
Well, indeed, they're actually encouraging people to issue those threats, aren't they? There's a very interesting. I don't know if people.
They're talking about a similar thing in Germany as well now. Mm. Actually, saying no, we don't want people to be allowed to wear these at all.
Well, it
almost makes you want to go out and buy one and wear it.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's some activists in Paris who actually did a protest where they were wearing a full face veil, but they were also wearing stockings and suspenders and wandering down the Champs-Élysées, just pointing out how ridiculous it was. You can't see my face, but you can see everything else. Is that okay? Of course, you know, there are fundamental issues here. If people want to wear, as adults, what clothes they want to wear, who is anybody else to tell them what they can and can't wear?
Good question. Anyway, so let's go back to Monday evening to the speech by Jeremy Corbyn, which wasn't transmitted on the transmitters we pay for, folks, through our licence fees. But anyway, let's have a listen now to some extracts from that. And the first one was where Jeremy Corbyn on College Green with his little audience of 2,000. I mean, he kind of does turn up, Martin, doesn't he? A little bit like a rock star.
Well, that's because there's a lot of people who actually appreciate his efforts, and he's beginning to touch a nerve in an electorate that's been denied this kind of socialist voice for a long time.
The message we're putting out is that we're calling time on the way in which politics and economics has been done in this country for a very long time. Others mentioned neoliberal economics. I remember speaking to a union branch meeting in the mid-1970s, and I was a union organizer for NUPE, National Union of Public Employees. A member said to me, brother, what does privatization mean? The Tory right-wing think tanks were starting down the road of privatization and rolling back the state. Ronald Reagan in the USA was promoting Proposition 13 in California to roll back the public services in California. Margaret Thatcher here was learning the same thing. And then we had the misery of the 1980s with Reaganomics in the United States and Thatcher economics here. Mass unemployment, attacks on trade unions, deindustrialization. The promotion of individualism and greed at the expense of the collective need of all of us. That was the watchwords that they put forward. And as it went on, those politics, those economics, those values infected so many others and so much other thinking. It even infected elements within our own party and our own labour movement in Britain. Yeah. And we have to call time on the economics that says poverty is inevitable, inequality is inevitable, grotesque levels of individual wealth are somehow or other a price the rest of us have to pay in the hope that one day some of that wealth might trickle down to the homeless on our streets. Well, it never did work like that, and it never should work like that. And so whilst at the last election, like all of you here, I was devastated by the result because I knew what was coming. I knew what a Tory government on its own would try to do. We knew all of that. But then you ask yourself some questions. Why was it that we didn't win that election?
We put a lot of work in, we put a huge amount of effort in, we all did that. But the fundamental problem was that we were not offering something sufficiently different. We were saying we would continue with the public sector wage freeze, thus penalising every public sector worker. And we said we would still make cuts. Because we seem not to have learnt the lesson of the banking crisis of 2008-09. Was it caused by greedy doctors, greedy nurses, greedy street cleaners? Was it caused by the greed of the homeless or those wanting somewhere decent to live? Or was it caused by an out-of-control banking system that fleeced us all in the process?
Well, that's a pretty good summary of the of Jeremy Corbyn's appeal to his core supporters, isn't it? And I think he didn't really extrapolate here, but the acceptance that there was a need to cut public expenditure. Interestingly enough, I think that the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, will probably decide in the autumn that we're not going to be cutting public expenditure anymore because it's suicidal. It always was suicidal.
And Corbyn there is talking about things like Reaganomics, Thatcherism, and the things that actually many people now have never experienced at all. This is going way back in history.
Yeah, but that's the whole point. I mean, if you, what's it, Bob Marley said, know your history, know your destiny, and the abundance of water, the fool is thirsty. The fact is that we've been going in the wrong direction for decades now. The Thatcher decades were the wrong direction. The New Labour decades, or the 19 years of New Labour, 13 years of New Labour, that wasn't going in the wrong direction as fast as the Tories, but it was still going in the wrong direction. There's a basic acceptance of things like privatised railways, privatised utilities. What we were told is we can't renationalise the railways, it's not a priority because we can't afford it. As soon as the banks have a cough or a cold, then suddenly the chequebook comes out and money's no object.
Well, look, you're talking about privatisation, nationalisation. I can remember the 1970s and I can remember the lights going out, power strikes, that kind of thing. This is under the nationalised electricity.
What that was about was the miners went on strike because they were unhappy with their wages, and the government refused to listen to them, and so they did what they could do to make their demands stick. And what happened with Edward Heath?
So what was happening was that the coal at the power stations was running out, effectively.
Yeah, well, what happened in 1974 under the old system? Edward Heath called a general election because he'd just been defeated by the miners for the second time, and said, who runs the country? This is what this is about. And the answer of the electorate was definitely not you, mate. Back in the day, in the 1970s, I remember the three-day week. I was in my teens. Lots of people supported the miners, and that's why the Tories lost the follow-on election.
Actually, a three-day week sounds quite good. Did you get paid the whole week's wages?
No, you didn't. But I mean, the fact is that people were far worse off in the 1980s when we had millions of unemployed and the whole of Britain was deindustrialised by an absurdly ideological policy pursued by the Tories. I mean, the mining communities have never recovered from what happened in the follow-on to the 1984 strike.
Going to recover because we've decided we're not using coal. But you sound to me like Jeremy Corbyn is the man who just wants to turn the clock back.
No, because what happens in the end is that the pendulum swings. You go through a long period of super capitalism, and then eventually some people realise, oh, we don't like super capitalism. And then, of course, you things become very socialistic. You get a high level of trade unions. And then the appeal to that we need a bit more free market sounds more plausible. But we've had free market up to here, and it's got us nowhere. And of course, it's not really a free market because we bail the banks out.
I'm convinced.
If you wouldn't have a free market, you let the banks collapse. Everybody lose their savings. Is everybody in favour of that?
I'm convinced in a kind of sane society we would all be on a three-day week. What with all the technology there is now, we shouldn't be having to work hours God sends just to pay the rent.
Back in the 70s we used to talk about that. What we were going to do to share work out and allow people to have a proper work-life balance and all the rest of it. But of course the Thatcher revolution put an end to that, and we're all working all the hours God sends now for less than minimum wage to keep the bosses in the style to which they've become accustomed. custom.
We'll be talking about that towards the end of the second hour after six, but let's go back to College Green on Monday evening, because Jeremy Corbyn also, when he was there, I suppose one of the main things he was talking about, really, as he decided to here in Bristol for whatever reason, was housing. So let's have a listen to see what he had to say about that. We all need a house. For many of us, it's a nightmare.
One other area of policy I want to mention before I say something else, and that is housing. There is a housing crisis facing every part of this country. In Bristol, it is a housing shortage, of the lack of council housing, of a council that's been told by the government it's got to sell off high-value properties, of tenants that are being told under pay to stay to get promotion at work, they might end up losing their access to council housing. Of a council that's been told, like everywhere else in the country, if it wants to develop housing, it's got to somehow or other balance its own payment system for it. Of those living in a private rented sector, insecure on 6 month tenancies, knowing that at some point, maybe very soon, they're going to be moved out and moved on. Of those people who have somehow or other dropped through the whole system because of family breakup, illness, all kinds of things, end up sleeping on the streets of this country, it'll be another night trying to get into a park while the rest of us leave a park after a lovely evening to go home. That is the reality of modern Britain. And for children growing up in an insecure private rented flat, knowing they might have to leave their mates and move school, having no security. And young people, even from relatively well-off backgrounds, totally unable to buy anywhere of their own to live. We have created a housing shortage in order that some people can make a great deal out of that housing shortage. I think we should approach things in a completely different way. Look at the issues in rural areas also, where villages have been developed into a summer second home for those that can afford a second home, a very poor existence for those who manage to remain in a rented place in that village but haven't got a car and the bus service has closed down and gradually rural life closes down around them because of a lack of investment in rural housing or in rural transport. The issues are fundamentally very, very similar. Are we to do nothing about this housing crisis, or instead, are we to look at it this way? If we invest in building good quality homes for people to live in, environmentally sustainable, passive house standard buildings, we achieve a lot of things. One, those that live in them will pay much less in energy bills. Two, they'll have somewhere secure to live for their entire life. Three, we create jobs for the building workers and all the way through the supply chain. And instead of the science of managing shortages and difficulties in housing, we'll be instead exciting developments to give everyone somewhere secure, reasonable and decent to live in. So that means building, it means regulating our private rented sector, it means so many other things as well. And that is just one or two of the many policies that we're putting forward. So when people say, well, hang on, this leadership campaign is all about personalities, I promise you it's not, because I'm not a personality. So what it's about is all of us, what we do together, how we think together, and how we change our society together to ensure that everybody together is included, not systematically excluding those that fall by the wayside through poverty, through ill health, through disability, or whatever else it happens to be.
Well, there he is infusing his core supporters, of which I am one. That's the sort of thing people want to hear, and that's the sort of thing he's telling them.
Okay, Martin, is that the best you can do? I mean, well, he's talking there about something which is really dear to everybody's hearts, what's housing. And that's not, he's not just talking about, he's actually spelling out, this is how I would do it, a little bit more than just saying, oh, I want to build houses, which is what we get year after year on here, people saying, I want to build houses.
Well, yes, but the fact is that the central government, I mean, the Tory government is actually going to sell off the social housing stock, which doesn't even belong to them. Although I understand that both in Scotland and Wales, that has been kiboshed.
Well, hang on, the government do actually subsidise housing association house building.
But yes, but at the same time, the assets are not supposedly belonging to the government. That was the whole point of setting up housing associations instead of having it run by local councils. So the fact of the matter is, and in fact, they've been withdrawing their subsidy from the sector.
I talked about the debate between Smith and Corbyn, and there was another one last night, which I'm afraid I couldn't get hold of the audio to that. But basically, Owen Smith said he would never serve in a Corbyn cabinet, come what may.
Well, that's up to him, isn't it? That's his decision. And if there's going to be a change in the electoral boundaries, as the Tories have promised, then he won't be an MP at the next election.
He said serving under Corbyn would be futile.
Well, that's up to him to say that. I mean, therefore, people can make up their minds whether they... I mean, if he said, if I lose this, I'll serve under Corbyn, that might make some people more inclined to vote for him. If he says things like, I'm not going to serve under you under any circumstances, well, he's, you know, that's a position he's taking.
He also says,
but then there will be implications for that about whether he's going to be an MP
makes a very
in 2020,
good, he makes
isn't
a very
it?
Good point, which is he would not, as Jeremy has done, he says, vote against my party 500 times. I will do what I've always done, which is to vote Labour.
In that case, he can carry on voting Labour, but he's not necessarily going to be the MP, is he? What MPs have got to realise is they're entitled...
He certainly is until 2020.
No, he can be deselected before 2020.
He's going to carry on being the MP. The Labour Party can't do anything about that at all.
Well, no, but he can be deselected as the Labour MP if that's the position that he ends up backing himself into. Now, what all of these people have got to realise...
He's not backing himself into anything. It's no skin off his nose if the Labour Party decides it doesn't want anything to do with him. He is the elected MP for that constituency.
Well, yes, he is. But
there's nothing member can do about it.
Ultimately, he could end up not being the Labour MP for that constituency. And therefore, when it comes to the next general election, he'll have to stand under another title.
What I'm saying is Democratic Labour. Why not? I mean, that's an obvious kind of word to use. But they are a party within the party. They're within their own right, particularly as MPs, to do what they want.
They are, and we're within our rights to kick them out of the Labour Party. Incidentally, by the way, one of the things we might do when all of this is over is tear up Tony Blair's Labour Party card. We can't send him to The Hague because it's not within our power, but we can certainly blackball him from the Labour Party. What these people have got to realise is they weren't elected because they're the wonderful Owen Smith. They were elected because they were Owen Smith Labour, especially in South Wales. And if they think they're going to stand against the Labour Party at the next election, well, good luck to them, but I don't think they're going to win. No chance.
Our final clip from Monday with Jeremy Corbyn's speech on College Green, where he talks about sharing technology again. That's popped up again, and it's going to pop up again in the second hour.
I've heard for too long, ever since the Reaganomics period of the 70s, that somehow or other, what my generation was given in terms of pensions, housing, education, and all these things is mysteriously not going to be available for my children's generation, and it certainly won't be available for my grandchildren's generation, and it definitely won't be available for the generations after that. And then you look at the headline figures around the world of the science and advances we're all making, the technology that is available, the growing wealth around the world, and you say, hang on a minute, if we're in a richer society, in a wealthier world, a more technical world, a more scientific world, surely to goodness, all that science could be used to share it out a bit, rather than taking it to the hands of a few, not too many.
Well, he's quite right. There's no reason why the current dispensation has to continue in the way that it is. It's purely ideological, and therefore it's reversible.
Well, one thing he's saying there is that it does look as if there may not be pensions. Even for people with private pensions or state pensions, they may go down the tubes in the future.
Well, indeed, that's quite right. It's not just a question of cutting the state pension. It may very well happen if the banks collapse that people are going to lose their non-state pensions too.
These pensions their whole lives to find that at the end of the day there's nothing left.
But that's the whole point about free market capitalism. You take a risk and you risk losing everything. It's not just a question of we take a risk, but at the end of it that we'll keep our money. In actual fact, if you want full-on free market capitalism, you've got to accept that you run the risk that the bank that your money is in, or the pension fund that you've paid into, will go bust and you lose everything. That's full-on free market capitalism of the 19th century variety, in which many people died in the workhouse, penniless.
Hospital chiefs confirm Grantham's accident and emergency will close overnight from Wednesday this week. The accident and emergency department of Grantham Hospital, that is. And also at 6:30 it will close each evening and reopen at 9 a.m. 7 days a week. It's proposed to operate the overnight closure in Grantham for 3 months. Hospital bosses announced yesterday and Wednesday a nighttime closure of Grantham's A&E department is necessary to combat a staffing crisis at Lincoln County and Boston Pilgrim hospitals. The nearest one, Martin, if something happens to you, a heart attack or something, or maybe something, you know, whatever it happens, 35 miles away in Lincoln now.
Well, the NHS is suffering from underfunding, just like the prison service, the police service, the tax collection service, the Magistrates' Revenue and Customs. Ultimately, I think there's a turning point going to be reached soon where it will become obvious that you can't cut public expenditure without threatening the health of the economy. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see which way Philip Hammond jumps in the autumn, because in actual fact, we've already decided that we're not going to cut the deficit and reduce it to zero by 2020. I think that's absolutely clear by what's happened in the last 3 months.
What about overnight closures of accident and emergency in a major city like Grantham?
Well, it may well be that it's time for the government. It's time for the government to pump some money in to prevent those things from happening. And if the Tories are smart, they will take a decisive turn to the left here. That's what they should do.
Southmead right now is in special measures. Massive deficit there.
Well, in that case, the government could actually make themselves popular by changing the way in which the NHS is funded. I mean, one of the problems is that we've got all these wretched hospital trusts, which are independent organisations. So when they get into trouble, the government can't just step in and help them out, or it can't do it without destroying its own ideology. But in actual fact, there's no reason why this should be happening, and the government could pull its finger out and do something about it. If they were smart, that's what they would do.
Also this week, return on UK government bonds is turning negative. Return on some UK government debt turned negative after the Bank of England missed its target in a new bond buying operation. The bank had offered to buy government bonds or gilts as part of its new quantitative easing programme to stimulate the economy. But the bank fell £52 million short of its £1.17 billion target when it failed to find enough sellers. That has driven up prices and pushed down the return or yield to investors. As bond prices rise, yields fall, and vice versa. So negative interest rates seem to be on the way here. But can you explain how this works, this bond buying QE programme?
Well, it's a bit complicated, but I mean, effectively what they do is they buy the bonds, are things that are, you know, they're government bonds that we're talking about here, and if you buy them back, you know, people are holding that as a kind of it's like a kind of gold standard government, a long dated government
bond.
You
lend money to the government and they say, well, here's a bond, and at a certain
these were long dated bonds, so the reason why they
don't, a bond is kind of a promise to pay
it's,
back
it's different from a stock or a share, which can go up or down or whatever. But bonds, especially long dated bonds, are the safest things in the market. And of course the pension funds, we were just discussing that earlier, and insurance companies and so on, they have to hold a pretty substantial chunk of these in order to make sure that they are, you know, safe as houses.
BBC business correspondent Jonty Bloom is saying the British economy is facing a huge potential problem, a liquidity trap. And I've heard you talk about that.
Well, a liquidity trap is a situation where, if it doesn't matter how cheap you make it to borrow money, if there is no demand in the economy, small businesses are not going to borrow money to invest in the future, nor are medium-sized businesses or large businesses, if there's no demand. And the fundamental problem with this liquidity trap was identified originally by John Maynard Keynes in the 1930s. It doesn't matter how cheap you make money, you can't make the economy go unless the government picks up the battle. Now, of course, that's what's being resisted by the Tory government, the idea that the government is responsible ultimately for the level of demand in the economy. Their belief is that the market will fix it if we just cut rates low enough. It's not going to work.
Also, election fraud allowed to take place in Muslim communities because of political correctness. This is the report by Eric Pickles into London voting fraud in East London. London, Martin. The election fraud has been allowed to take place in Muslim communities because of political correctness. That is needs unprecedented reform of the British voting system, basically saying it's far too easy to get a postal vote without any proper evidence.
Well, this is Eric Pickles who's inquiry has discovered this. If it's the case, then something's got to be done about it. Obviously, electoral fraud is not to be tolerated in any community.
Interesting that Eric is blaming, rather than the Tory party who are embroiled in their own election fraud scandal, he's blaming Muslims.
Well, indeed, but of course nobody should be cheating. Everybody should be playing by the rules, whether they're Muslim, non-Muslim, Tory or whatever else they are.
Well, he looks straight out of the Olympics. He's run all the way from Avonmouth to here, and he's right with us now, Gary Hopkins, with 5 minutes to go.
Hi. Do you want to just comment? Apologies for being late, but it was a meeting I could not miss.
Okay. Do you want to just comment on this story? Because this has been running for about a year, this inquiry. Eric Pickles has decided that Muslim communities and political correctness, a little bit like the Rotherham scandal, local authorities didn't really want to do anything about it because they were upset, they were afraid of being accused of being racist to do anything.
I'm afraid Eric's not one of my favourite people. We had a very well publicised
punch-up
encounter where actually the BBC helped me set him up quite nicely, and he finished up threatening the BBC reporter. But this is a distraction tactic, isn't it, from Pickles, to distract people away from the Conservatives' involvement, shall we say.
How safe do you think postal votes are?
I don't think they're safe at all under the present system. I think there's considerable concern about them, and I think that the whole thing needs to be looked at. Not just one particular group, but the whole gamut of the way the postal voting system is working.
Okay, Gary, also, when I spoke to you yesterday, you said you had something you wanted to share with us, so you want to do that before quick you get beaten by Murdoch on the news.
Right. Well, I mean, there's been a massive cutback from First in the services that they're offering, and we've actually been doing some investigation into this, and it's not because they're closing down loss-making services. They've basically secured extra contracts, and as a result, they haven't got the capacity, so whole communities are about to
when
be
you say
cut
capacity,
off.
Do you mean drivers, buses, what?
Drivers and buses. They haven't got enough room in their depots now for the number of buses they actually need, and they're trying to tell us on one of the main cuts they're making, 51 bus, goes through Hengrove, Whitchurch, Knowle, and down towards Temple Mead. And basically they said, that's loss-making. That is rubbish. We've actually counted the number of passengers. We know what the situation is. And basically it's not making quite as much profit as some of their other services. And we've been in discussion about getting a replacement bus operator for that, which is what the assistant mayor and council officers should have been doing. But instead of that, it was actually kept under wraps for a month. First had a legal duty to inform the council, which they did, and for a month we heard nothing. So the local councillors and potential competitors didn't hear that.
So who's in charge of transport these days?
Sorry?
Who's in charge of transport these days?
Well, apparently nobody. The executive member, or if they're called executive members now, the assistant mayor is Councillor Bradshaw, and myself and Councillor Kent, who represents the next
bringing
door.
In this wonderful metro bus, which is going to save the planet, maybe, if we can get through all the roadworks.
The trouble with the metro bus is that they're about to try and run it on a quality bus partnership, which is an absolute load of nonsense. It needs to be a contracted service, and the way that they're actually downgrading the way that it's going to work and taking a short-term view on it and not actually getting to grips with the rest of the services that need to work with it, it could now be a bit of a problem financially, whereas if run properly, it was a potential godsend for Bristol traffic.
Final word I'm going to give also to you, Gary, which is about, we're going back to the election fraud business, I suppose, which is looking up at Thornbury and Yate is one of these constituencies which the police are supposed to be looking into. I wonder if you've heard any more about this, because it seems to have completely dropped off the radar. I get the idea that the police have spiked the story. In other words, I mean, a bit done what journalists do sometimes, just put it on the back burner and forget about it.
I couldn't possibly comment about that, but I'm sure you've got your own views, and I don't think that the public are being well served by the lack of thorough investigation.
Martin, what are your thoughts on Tory election fraud?
They're trying to cover it up, and they're just kicking it all into the long grass in the hopes that it'll go away. Hopefully not. Hopefully the police are going to fulfil what they said they were going to do.
Oh, all right, fingers crossed for the coppers. Okay, well, time for the Murdoch News at 6. After the news 20 years ago this week, on the Tuesday, the 13th of August 1996, three arrests in Brussels began the De Trou scandal.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.